I gotta be me. I gotta be me. What else can I be but what I am?
Hello, this is Jamie McGregor from the SammyDavisJr.info website. I had the good fortune a couple of days ago to see a screening of the fantastic new documentary called Sammy Davis Jr., I've Gotta Be Me, which was playing at the Jewish International Film Festival in Sydney, Australia. And I'm joined on the line by the writer of that documentary, Larry Maslon, a man of many talents. He's the host of his own radio series, Broadway to Main Street, which is also available as a podcast. He's a professor at NYU, a music theatre historian and writer who has written in print and for television about film and theatre musicals, and even wrote the book Superheroes, Capes, Cowls, and the Creation of the Comic Book Culture. Obviously a fan of alliteration as well. Thanks, Larry, for taking the time out to speak to me about the documentary.
I couldn't be happier. Here's a shout out to all the Sammy fans around the globe, and I just want to praise you for your really superb website and for spreading the Sammy joy around the world.
Thank you. First off, I thought I'd ask you a bit about how you became a Sammy fan, and I'm just wondering, with your interest in superheroes, whether there might be something about Sammy's kind of variety of entertainment superpowers and his kind of comic book larger-than-life, you know, existence that appealed to you at all?
Well, it's sort of a question of two ends meeting in the middle. What you mentioned, this book, Superheroes, that I wrote, I've worked on three major television documentaries with Michael Cantor, who's the executive producer of American Masters, that produced the Sammy documentary. And the last one we did was on superheroes. And the first one we did was on Broadway musicals. And the one in the middle was about American comedy. And I've written the companion books to all three documentaries. I mean, copiously illustrated 400-page books. And I'm happy to say that I've managed to sneak a picture of Sammy Davis Jr. into all three of them. The Broadway book has a nice chapter on, or section on, Golden Boy. The comedy book has a good section on All in the Family, of course, Sammy's Visit. And the third, as fans may be wondering, what the hell is going to go in there? In the frontispiece for the book is Sammy talking to the Cape Crusaders on his guest appearance on Batman.
Of course, on Batman, yes.
So that also all works together. And in terms of my interest in Sammy, I do remember when I was probably 8 or 9, the local library had an LP of Golden Boy. And I sort of went through my musicals. I have to say, I don't think it landed that strongly with me at the age of 9. But I saw Sammy a lot. He was ubiquitous on American television in 1969, 1970. Sammy's Visit, obviously, from All in the Family, 1972, yep. I think. Laugh-In, which he was on so many times, which was my favorite show growing up. So I certainly knew about him. And I don't think he really, though, kind of clicked into me until I went back probably in the 80s and really dug into Golden Boy. And then that's when CDs came in, so I started really buying a lot of music on CD that I hadn't bought on LP. And, you know, really fell in love with Sammy's Back on Broadway and The Wham of Sam and all those albums, and it just sort of snowballed from that point on.
Awesome. So in terms of the documentary itself, did you have a kind of a script or treatment before you started doing serious research or collecting kind of archival material for the documentary? How did it all kind of start?
Well, as I mentioned, Michael Cantor, who's a major American documentary producer-director, took over the reins of a show here called American Masters on PBS. It's been around for 20 years, and it's done biographies of everyone. And I remember, I don't know, let's say, for example, he signed, I'm guessing, February 1st, 2013, he took over. And exactly 2 weeks later, on the 15th, I called him and I said, okay, it's been 2 weeks. You've, you know, unpacked your stuff. You know where the bathroom is at PBS. When are we going to do Sammy? And it was actually the first project under his tenure that they did, because he knew how much I love Sammy. And we'd also... We felt it's interesting. Golden Boy, which is a huge show for me personally, didn't really make it to the 6-hour Broadway documentary. made it into the book because we had more space. So I felt like Sammy was always hovering around, looking for his moment in the sun, as it were. So he said, that's a great idea. Let's get started. I wrote a treatment and a script, and we applied to the National Endowment for the Humanities and got a $500,000 grant, which was about, you know, close to 40% of what we needed to get started. And we got started and we were off and running. So took about 2.5 years to make, but there you are.
So when you first conceived of it, what was the story that you wanted to tell about Sammy?
Well, and I can send this to you, because you probably know it, but I always loved it. Mad Magazine in 1968 ran a spoof called Racial Stereotypes by the Numbers. And it was this sort of gag of how people stereotype other races in America. And it had like Jewish people. One Jew is a stand-up comic. Two Jews is a tailor shop. Three Jews is a folk song group or whatever it was. And they had Negroes, which is what African-Americans were obviously referred to back then. And it had one Negro is, I don't know, someone who moves into your neighborhood. Two Negroes is a prize fight. Three Negroes is an emerging African nation. Four Negroes is Sammy Davis Jr.
Right.
And that just stuck with me, I think, since I read it in 1968. And I thought that's was true. And originally the documentary was called I've Got to Be Me, The Many Lives of Sammy Davis Jr.
Okay.
We ultimately reversed the title. And I thought that was it. I mean, how do you capture somebody who had so many lives and so many identities and yet still had to be me? I got to be me. What is that if you're so talented? If you're four people, five people, 10 people, who is the me? And obviously, in so many ways, Sammy's journey was his search for who he was and who he wanted to be and how they kept moving the goalposts throughout his life. And, you know, once we got the money, we were, as I said, off and running. We reached out to Sam Pollard, who's not only a major documentarian, but a colleague of mine at NYU, where I teach, and he also teaches in the graduate film program. It didn't work out with his schedule. We started with another director. That didn't work out. And happily, we got Sam back on board. And over the course of 3 years, we filmed an awful lot of people. And it came together, I have to say, very easily.
So I can imagine that some people might think that kind of writing a documentary is trivial, perhaps, compared to a piece of fiction, which has, you know, a script which you follow and you have to, you know, invent. But I would have thought shaping a narrative for a documentary would actually be incredibly tricky. And in particular with this documentary, having seen it, I particularly liked the way that the documentary melded a kind of a thematic structure, those many lives you talk about, dancer, singer, leading man, etc. But, you know, cleverly interweaves a kind of a chronological structure so that you start with him as a prodigy and you finish it with the 60th anniversary. So what was the process of kind of shaping that narrative?
Again, I guess I was so inspired by this Mad Magazine cartoon. I thought, what were the... you had to fall in love with him as a performer first, for sure. So it was very easy to see as he went on, which is true chronologically. He started as a dancer. He added singing. He added impressions. So that was the first four slots there. And then he started to expand as a human being. And, patriot, leading man. I think it was originally called actor. And then this is the Golden Boy segment. And then somebody said, he's more than didn't he already act? And you go, yeah. So what did he want? He wanted to be a leading man. He dropped the junior, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of interesting stuff with Golden Boy. And as he went on, he became more engaged politically and socially, activist, patriot, rebel, all sorts of things. We moved some stuff around. We debated a lot what those terms should be. But again, once you had that, you were sort of off and running because you could see the many guises that he took on. And I got to say, if you can't write structure is important, but if you can't piece together an interesting documentary on Sammy Davis Jr., I mean, then you're screwed. You should go home. Yeah. But one thing that did happen was the beginning of the documentary, I don't want no spoiler alert, but it was really, really, really felicitous that this tipping point, it seemed to me as a person, was this embrace of Nixon. And not so much that in 72, but the fallout in the black community, because people asked me, what's the arc of the thing? And I said, well, one arc is Sammy spent 2/3 of his life trying to be liked by white people. And when the moment that happened, he started to be hated by black people. And so we talk about this Push concert where he was really railed against by the black attendees of Jesse Jackson's conference post Nixon. And again, the two felicitous things were, A, we found a tape recording of him talking about that. He said, that really hurt me more than anything. You know, you can hate me as a person, but don't boo me as an entertainer. And what does he go on and sing? He doesn't go on and sing the Candyman. He goes on and sings, I've Got to Be Me. And to me, that was this amazingly felicitous song that said everything about Sammy. His whole life was spent trying to be me.
What an amazing coincidence that had been filmed for the documentary, movie that you're able to actually use that. That must have been that must have been amazing. Can you talk me through the thinking around simply using kind of talking heads and Sammy's own narration through the documentary, as opposed to having a kind of a set narrator? What do you think the advantages were?
Well,
and maybe
it's funny,
the trade-offs?
Originally there was narration. As a documentary writer, you go, oh, please don't cut my sentence here and my sentence there. And we said, oh, well, we'll get Don Cheadle. We'll get, for some reason, Don Cheadle was always number one to narrate it, even though no one ever called him. And as it went on, we didn't need it. He just sort of narrated his own life, and you're off and running. We always said that when you were in trouble, which we never really were, but cut to Sammy. And who could be better telling his own story? You know, his autobiography was – his first one was a bestseller, so he knew how to talk about himself.
And it's not like he shied away from, talk shows and introspection at all, is it?
No, I mean, the opposite, of course. Exactly. He was one of 20th century's great extroverts, but he was a good extrovert, which was helpful. I mean, I think Sinatra, for instance, was obviously less extroverted, but Sinatra didn't give away as much on camera as Sammy did, so it was helpful.
You mentioned the books. What did you? I mean, I can imagine you read them 1,000 times over in preparation to build everything together. But what was your reaction from reading them? Was there anything in particular you took with a bit of grain of salt, or?
Again, his life has been documented. I suppose after he died, you would know this better than I. There was a spate of books that came out. None of which I think were particularly wonderful. Some of them were written by people who didn't understand show business, in my opinion. Some were written with an axe to grind. And for me, the best thing was the Sammy Davis Reader by Gerald Early, which I think went in and out of print in about 2 weeks, which was too bad.
And he's in the documentary, which is great. And he is in the documentary.
Yeah, so I mean, we couldn't have done it without Gerald. I mean, he was a tough get, but when we got him, he was fantastic. So, again, he's so well documented. He's so out there. It was easy. I guess there had been a few other attempts. It looked like there was a BBC documentary called The Kid in the Middle, which I stopped watching halfway through just because I didn't really want to be influenced by it. That didn't seem to get him. So that was interesting. And then, of course, you start talking to people, and that's talking heads is the way we make documentaries. I guess you can make them without them, but it seemed silly. Since he had only really passed away fairly recently, not to use those people. And we got Jerry Lewis, for Pete's sake. Jerry,
hilarious.
Well, there was a lot more of Jerry. It was a tough day with Jerry. I mean, he was, you can see he's not at his most vigorous, but, Jerry Lewis is famously difficult human being. Was like, you want to talk about Sammy? When do you want to come over? And he was incredibly gracious and incredibly loving about Sammy, as were Steve Lawrence, who frankly didn't make it into the cut, which killed me. But people wanted to talk about him, and we got great people, so there you are.
Can you talk me through a little bit around the process of collecting archival material? Where do you go looking for that kind of
stuff? Well, there are two parts to that. The easy part is, again, we the documentary was over $1 million. It's an expensive proposition because you have to clear music and tons of it, right? So every time somebody sings Me in My Shadow, that's another, you know, $10,000 or whatever. But PBS is a major, it's a major production company. It's probably the best at making, producing documentaries. And we had a producer, Sally Rosenthal, who's been doing this for years, a battery of people who just search the databases and bring stuff in. So that's not all that rare. I mean, that's sort of business as usual. And again, with Sammy, it was easy. I mean, I'll tell you one little thing, and then one big thing is there is a lot about the interracial romance in Golden Boy, and the song, as your listeners know, I Want to Be With You. And they were like, oh, gee, we can't find any recording of Sammy singing this to a white person on television in the 60s. And you go, duh, no one would have allowed that to be filmed in the 1960s. So luckily he sang a little bit of it on his last television show, but by himself. So you got to work around some of those things. And the other thing was that we worked out an arrangement with the estate of Sammy Davis, which is your listeners may know, is incredibly complicated. I believe when he died, he left more money due to the IRS than any single individual in history up to that point. And it took
a fact
decades.
You kindly did leave out of the documentary.
Yeah, well, I mean, well, you sort of get the point, right?
Yeah.
But his son Manny eventually held the keys, literally, because there were two storage lockers in Burbank that had not really been opened since he died. And we were able to go in there and digitize, I think, 2,000 pictures that he took, many of which are in the documentary. In the crawl, the end credits, I don't know if you stuck around for that, but all their photos of pictures of Marilyn Monroe and Jackie Kennedy, people, the shots that he took. He was an expert photographer. And his scrapbooks, so all that Will Mastin stuff, all the places they played. And one little tidbit was Jerry told the story about going to Ciro's, as did in Help Me 51, I think, taking notes on Sammy's act and saying, you're too deferential to the audience. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. He said, you know, who the fuck are you, Laurence Olivier? Or treating Will and his father like side, don't hand them your props like that, you know, all these little notes. And we were cleaning up this massive, massive storage bunker with yellowed clippings. You know, it looked like confetti on the floor after we were done for 8 hours. And there was a card from Ciro's, a little table card, like a menu. And it said, don't talk like Laurence Olivier.
Wow.
Don't give the props. And it was Jerry's handwritten notes for that event. We were actually able to show Jerry that. And he said, yeah, that's what I, you know, so we really hit the jackpot.
That's amazing. So along the way, did you discover anything in this process that you, not necessarily that surprised you, but that was just totally unexpected that you learned about Sammy or that you found out along the way?
Well, my father's cousin is a guy named Buzz Cohan, who's still with us, thankfully, who produced a lot of Sammy's television in the 60s and went to write the 60th anniversary special. So we interviewed him. And he mentioned this great story that Sammy had an office on like 47th Street and a studio on 55th Street in Manhattan. And one day he said, come on, let's go out to lunch or whatever. And he walked the entire crew up that 8 blocks. And in 8 blocks, they stopped in every store and spent $50,000, or Sammy spent $50,000 on watches and wristwatch and overcoats and stuff like that. So those were great stories. I can't say there was anything I came across that was astonishingly new from a biographical point of view, but people's perceptions about Sammy, especially Margot Jefferson, great critic, and it's so early in the morning. Why am I blanking on his name? He's a colleague of mine. I'll remember him from NYU. Talked about being black in the 1950s and what it meant to have a black person
right, on television.
On television.
Yeah.
And they both told the same story. It's like you'd call all around your friends and relatives, oh my God, you've got to turn on the TV at 7:30 because Lena Horne or Sammy's actually on television, because black representation on television in the 50s was so minimal. So that was fascinating to me.
Speaking of the people that you got to interview, I mean, obviously the big names, Whoopi Goldberg and Billy Crystal, I must say I was actually really impressed by their understanding of Sammy and his career and his, you know, Billy Crystal I knew was, you know, had opened for him and was quite close to him. But Whoopi in particular had some excellent insights and showed a very clear understanding of who Sammy was, which I thought was fantastic.
Yeah, well, Billy, you could have done an hour of Billy on Sammy alone. His anecdotes, his stories about hanging out with him in Vegas. I mean, they, at one point he said Sammy would always have a buffet backstage, and there was one buffet, I guess they were playing some venue where the buffet table was sort of on a flight of at the head of a flight of stairs. And he said without Sammy seeing it, Billy stole an olive off the table and went up to Sammy and sort of slapped him in the back and threw the olive down the stairs and said, oh my God, your eye fell out, Sam, you know. So that was interesting. And Cheetah Rivera, it was also fantastic, talking about Mr. Wonderful. We deleted that segment for time, but she was amazing. She told me this story that I loved. I was the only person who liked it, whoever wanted it in the documentary, that she was dating Sammy during Mr. Wonderful. And they went out somewhere in public at a restaurant, and they got into some kind of fight, and he took out his eye and put it on top of the coffee cup or whatever, coffee saucer, and said, is that what you want from me? Is that what you want from me? And she said, I'll never forget that moment. So,
wow. Jeez.
Yeah. It's a little hard to get back into the story after that. But no, I mean, these people love – I mean, again, you know – Billy, his insights are great because that's a whole other thing we couldn't get into the doc. He imitated Sammy. Sammy was in blackface as a kid, and Billy Crystal was in blackface. Couldn't get away with that now, I don't think.
No.
80s imitating Sammy. So he knew him. It wasn't just like, oh, I imitated him once on television. He opened for him. They were best friends. He told a story about going to Sammy's house in Beverly Hills and, you know, going up to the bathroom and getting lost or something, or he opened the closet he thought was the bathroom, and they're hanging in the back of the closet, you know, behind 50 leather and velour suits of Sammy's was a photo of Sammy hugging Nixon. So Sammy had obviously, like Dorian Gray, kept that in the closet for decades.
The Kim Novak interview, where was that something that was done for this specific documentary?
Yeah, I was not there for that filming, so I really can't talk much, not that I don't want to, I just can't talk much about that. That was done by a sort of interim director / interviewer who did an okay job, but not a great job, in my opinion,
right,
with that particular interview. And that's a story, I mean, I don't
know. I found it interesting because she, you know, in the past, she's, you know, slightly different stories about exactly what happened over time, which is, you know, understandable. So it was just interesting to hear, you know, how she was edited and what she thinks now.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, she portrayed their relationship as an innocent one. She was having an affair with a married film director at the time named Richard Quine, who later went on to do a lot of TV. And she said, I really didn't want to have an affair with Sammy. I was already having an affair with someone. Sammy tells a different story. I don't know. I don't know that it matters whether they actually slept together or how often they slept together or under what conditions they slept together. But clearly the damage was done
Just a couple of things about some of the great clips that you included that I just thought I'd mention. The clip about Eddie Cantor from 52 and you could have included that there was more to say about the reaction to that. You certainly alluded to it, but that is a phenomenal clip to include. And the other thing I wanted to ask you about was the clip from Porgy and Bess, because now that must have been hard to find, because I'm all the reading I've done indicates there's like only two surviving prints or something, and you need to
three.
You know, it's almost impossible to get. But it looked brilliant. Like it was watching the documentary, that was the best thing on screen, and the whole like the picture was phenomenal.
Well, I'm glad you think so. Let me talk for the Eddie Cantor thing. We by, again, this strange connection that Sammy has with everyone, our grant officer at the National Endowment for the Humanities, in other words, the guy who essentially helped get us $500,000 or pulled the lever, whatever, great guy named David Weinstein, and he had been writing for 5 years a biography of Eddie Cantor. And in passing, he said, you know, I've looked at the NBC files. I've gone through everything. This wave of hate mail that Sammy talks about, these bags and bags of hate mail that Sammy talks about in I Think Yes I Can, he said, I don't think that's true. So he said, certainly it ruffled people's feathers. So I think we sort of
made the side of rather than overplaying it.
Yeah, I mean, you see him. You see what happens. We have the footage. What is it? Well, you know, if you have any cognizance about life in America in the '50s, you get it. And Porgy and Bess, there are only three copies in existence. I think that one is from the Library of Congress. There's never been a master struck, so we actually didn't like the quality of it as much as some of the other. You know, the original is better looking. And that, again, was you never know where roads lead to. I think the reason we got it was because Michael had done such a good job with this Broadway documentary in 2004 that we were very friendly with the Gershwin Estate. And we made a case that, you know, this is a great performance and it's not about Sidney Poitier being dubbed or whatever the heck that was about. It's yeah. Let's get it out. And we got it out there and we're very proud of that.
I think you've got to remember I'm comparing this to the copy of a copy of a, you know, bootleg that I may have seen of the whole movie. So to see it on the big screen at least was great.
Well, maybe it'll be, you know, what is it, a thin edge of a thick wedge, and maybe they'll see the wisdom of releasing it because it's pretty phenomenal.
So just talking about Sammy and his time in musicals, why do you think that he was drawn to musicals in a way that, you know, kind of a lot of his contemporaries really weren't? I suppose you could argue that musical theater is one place where all of his various talents could kind of, you know, the singer, the dancer, the actor, the comic in him could all kind of coalesce. But was that it, or was there more to it, do you think?
Well, I think there are lots of things. I mean, one thing is something you actually quote on your website, is in the, you know, from the moment he was born in New York City, he grew up, you know, a stone's throw from the Cotton Club. He grew up with people like Bill Robinson and in his orbit. And he knew that Broadway was it. Broadway was the cultural imprimatur of the time. That's how you – it wasn't a question of showing off your talent. It meant that the world recognized that you were a great artist. And so that was in his blood. He'd obviously sung an insane amount of Broadway material on Decca. Hey There was his big hit from the Pajama Game, but and then he quickly went into Mr. Wonderful, so he had a taste of that. But Mr. Wonderful, I think it always nagged at him that he was considered a performer when he did Mr. Wonderful, not an actor. And he was – if Hillard Elkins hadn't come to him with Golden Boy, I don't know that he necessarily would have – who knows what would have happened. But it did happen. And it was a time, I think, when he wanted to get away from the Rat Pack anyway.
Yeah.
One thing that never made it into the documentary that I'd written early on was a montage or something where you see Sammy, the Will Mastin trio starring Sammy Davis Jr. and the Jr. disappears and you just see Sammy Davis in Golden Boy. I think that was a big, big moment for him. Ironically, and he talks about this on these Burt Boyard tapes we found at the Library of Congress, that he said, you know, shit, man, you know, 1956, I got the reviews of a lifetime in Mr. Wonderful. And, you know, a month later, My Fair Lady opens. And 1963, 64, I go back to Broadway and I get the reviews of a lifetime. And a month later, Fiddler on the Roof opens. Yeah. So I think he felt he was sort of – he was never going to – he gave two once-in-a-lifetime performances, and it just was the wrong year for that. But I think he loved Broadway, and he did so much to bring it. It's the subject of a book that I'm writing now that's going to come out in August about how these guys sold Broadway to America. Frank never dared do it. Dean never dared do it. Tony Bennett was never on Broadway. Bing Crosby was never on Broadway. Judy Garland was never on Broadway. I mean, the list is endless. Yeah. But Sammy was like, forget it. I'll lose money, but I'll be on Broadway 8 times a week. And I think people forget he did Golden Boy for 4 years in one venue or another. That's insane. I mean, that's like you're talking Yul Brynner and the King and I territory. So he obviously loved that show. It meant something to him, and it meant something to be a leading man on Broadway. Whether he was 100% every night is, you know, debatable, but he did it. He was there. He showed up.
And people kept buying tickets.
Yep.
And how that show actually modified into the 68 version is actually a fascinating story in itself of following the change in the civil rights movement into the black power kind of culture. And you kind of alluded to that around the, you know, he spends his entire life seeking the approval of white audiences, and then all of a sudden he has to seek the approval of black audiences. I did think that the comment that Leslie Bricus made about, you know, people say that Sammy wanted to be white, but, you know, he would have had no color if he could. What do you think about the kind of people who try to psychoanalyze Sammy in retrospect about wanting to be white?
I think he wanted to be liked, and that's what he knew. And I think he always felt that who he was and what he could give to the world should have been, as Duke Ellington said, beyond category. And he was always categorized by other people. I mean, I see his struggle as a struggle of the self and the other. I mean, not to get too heavy, but, you know, he had a lot to offer, and society just kept changing the terms. It's like, you know, switching bait and switch his whole life. And I think it's not so much that he didn't want to be no color. He just wanted one set of rules, you know, in 1925. And could those please be the rules for the rest of my life, just like they were for 99% of white people?
You talk about the rules. There was something about Sammy that was different, though. You mentioned in the documentary, you know, Harry Belafonte and his white you know, wife did not get disinvited from the inaugural. And you in through all of the stuff about Richard Nixon, people forget James Brown was supporting Nixon, but he never got the same
criticism. We had a whole James Brown section that eventually got cut, but yes,
absolutely. So what was it about Sammy?
I think it could be a lot of things. Again, he was a lightning rod. One of the chapter headings was called Provocateur, was changed to Rebel because we didn't think people understood what that meant. I think he was passive aggressive, I think, about his own individuality. He made choices. What black person in America of that stature decides to be Jewish? It's like what Archie Bunker, what made you decide to become Jew? You know, what person like that dates a white movie star? And on and on. So I think it wasn't one thing. It was a lot of things it added. I would imagine, although other black commentators could speak to this more with more integrity than I, his skin color. Harry Belafonte was a very light-skinned African-American. Nat King Cole was an elder statesman by that point. And maybe there was something about Sammy's obsequiousness, frankly. I mean, that was something that he always seemed to exude that turned people off who were in positions of power. So it was just a combination of lots of things.
I do want to touch on the relationship with Nixon. And I was really stunned to see Bob Brown in the documentary, which was fantastic. And of course, there seems to be he says very clearly that he did not feel that Nixon or that administration manipulated or took advantage of Sammy in any way. And I'm wondering, do you actually think that Sammy kind of let the sinecures cloud his better judgment? Or do you actually think that he did feel that he was making headway with someone who was listening to him on issues that were important to him?
How about see all of the above? Again, look at the trajectory. Here's a guy who never went to school, who wound up campaigning for president in 1960. And then got told, I mean, he said that I think being disinvited to the inaugural ball and the inaugural event and was one of the, up to that point, I think the thing that hurt him the most. He said, you know, the fact they don't want me there as an entertainer is what kills me. And so then 10 years later, another president rolls along and says, no, I get you. I understand you. You mean something to me. you know, why don't you come over? Come over to the White House. Well, I mean, the way in which Nixon sincerely tees up Sammy in the documentary, I think, is profound. And what person wouldn't be affected by that? So history tells us, of course, through a later lens, that Nixon was, you know, a horrendous human being in many ways. But I don't think he exploited Sammy the way that we would like to think that people get exploited, if that makes sense. Yeah. Bob Brown talked a lot about their relationship and how Sammy, you know, came in and how he was worked with the Nixon staff and stuff like that. And he says that he was his own man. He could have said, you know, screw this crap. I'm not going to do it. But he didn't. And it was an exciting time for him. You know, he rose to that occasion. Some people might say he rose to the bait. I would say he rose to the occasion. And as in many things in his life, he was a little naive about its implications. But I'd certainly understand it. Would you or I have done the same thing? I have no idea. But I see why Sammy did it.
Okay. I think the last thing I just wanted to ask was, do you have a favorite Sammy film clip that you used in the or a favorite song or album that you have of Sammy's that you were excited made it into the documentary?
Wow. Well, one little thing, you know, there's a lot, if you watch it carefully, the song tracks are very assonant, if that's the word I would use. Okay. They sort of resonant, maybe that's a better word. I was very pleased, sad though that is, in the section called Survivor, which begins with his accident in San Bernardino, the music is Lonesome Road, Look Down That Lonesome Road. So I think that was a nice match of song to what he was doing. No, I mean,
I noticed you played every time we say goodbye over the montage of the family.
Yeah,
as well.
That was the editor's choice. I think he did a great job with that. Or there's What Kind of Fool Am I when he meets My Brit. So I mean, how could you pick one out of many? I mean, I'm sure like you, you know, on a Monday I'll wake up and The Shelter of Your Arms is my favorite song. And then Tuesday I Wake Up and the Carmen McRae duet album is my favorite album. And, you know, Sammy is so great and so multifaceted and such a great singer. I wish we had more time to spend on his singing, actually.
I would have thought hard to build into a visual medium like a documentary, though.
Exactly. And certainly his recording career. But he just did so much stuff, as you know. You're the master of his discography, which was incredibly helpful, by the way. I have to give you a shout out. I don't know. I mean, it comes back to – we had a clip at one point of Steve Lawrence singing I've Gotta Be Me. He introduced it on Broadway and then sort of segue into Sammy. And I love Steve Lawrence. But when Sammy sings it, you know, 101 aspects of American culture – sort of pile into what that song means when it's sung by someone like Sammy. So I think everything he did was to me so resonant and so clever. And, you know, at the end of the day, you got 110% with him. 24/7, he gave you 110%. And I just hope people who watch the documentary appreciate that. And the best comments that we have gotten are the faces of people who see the documentary and they were like, yeah, maybe I saw him growing up or I kind of dismissed him or I wrote him off in the 70s. But thank you for restoring to us what an amazing talent he was. And, you know, he's the most talented person of the 20th century for sure. And I call him the human Venn diagram, because who else worked with Ethel Waters and Michael Jackson? Who else intersected with John Kennedy and Richard Nixon? Who else intersected with Archie Bunker and Martin Luther King? Eddie Cantor and Billy Crystal. I mean, the list is endless.
Yeah.
So he certainly repays whatever effort you spend on him. And like you, of course, is a source of endless fascination, but a source of endless pleasure.
Larry, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to geek out a bit on Sammy with me. I really appreciate it. And congratulations again on the documentary. I hope that it goes to plenty more film festivals around the world so that other Sammy fans get a chance to see it. And then obviously when it runs on television in the US as well. So thank you very much.
And someday it'll be on home video or the equivalent thereof.
Hopefully a a Blu-ray or a DVD with a huge number of extras that hit the cutting room floor. That would be even better. So, thank you once again. I gotta be free.